This is Josh Barrow, and welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. It is the first full week of August, and this week we were focused on two mass shootings that occurred last weekend at a Walmart store in El Paso, where a shooter killed 22 people, and then hours later in the Oregon District, a nightlife area in Dayton, Ohio, where a shooter killed 9 and himself. In the second segment of today's show, we'll talk about the white nationalist views that appear to have motivated the El Paso shooter to target Hispanics. That El Paso Walmart is located very near the Mexican border and is frequented by both Mexican Americans and Mexican nationals. We will also talk later about the escalating trade and now currency war with China, and what more tariffs and a weaker Chinese yuan could mean for American consumers and American politics. Now let's bring in our Left, Right, and Center panel. As always, I'm your center, and I'm joined by Rich Lowry, editor of National Review on the right. On the left is Sabeel Rahman, president of Demos. Hello.
Hey, Josh.
Hi, Josh. Hi, Rich.
Congress is out of session right now. President Trump spoke on Friday morning saying he and congressional Republicans do intend to do something on gun background checks when it comes back.
We need intelligent background checks, okay? This isn't a question of NRA, Republican, or Democrat. I will tell you, I spoke to Mitch McConnell yesterday. He's totally on board. He said, I've been waiting for your call. He is totally on board. I spoke to senators that in some cases, people, friends of mine, but pretty hardline senators, hardline. And when I say that in a positive way, hardline on the Second Amendment. And they understand, we don't want insane people, mentally ill people, bad people, dangerous people. We don't want guns in the hands of the wrong people. I think that the Republicans are going to be great and lead the charge along with the Democrats.
Robert Costa has a story in the Washington Post about how Republican strategists are concerned that gun issues have hurt their ability to win in the suburbs, contributed to their loss of the House of Representatives in 2018. Rich, do you think there might be a genuine change here that Republicans, for the first time in a long time, feel politically compelled to be seen to be doing something about guns?
Well, I think there is an emerging consensus around the idea of a red flag bill. And it's a little unclear in that statement from Trump. Initially, he says background checks, but at the end, he seems to be describing what would be a red flag law, which allows certain people around a dangerous or disturbed individual to petition a judge who can block that person from having from owning or buying a gun for some period of time. As we talked about before, I think that's something that makes sense. I think it has to be carefully crafted, but it does have the potential at least to stop some of these attacks. The rest of the gun legislation, I just don't think would have any practical effect. I think, you know, always we have a balance between freedom and security. Our default should always be freedom, but at times security should matter more. I think this is one of those times. So I'm willing to give there. I just don't think any of the other gun legislation proposed would have interacts with this problem really at all.
Yeah, Sabeel, as Rich notes, red flag laws, both federally and at the state level, seem to be one of the areas where you're seeing some emerging bipartisan consensus around guns. But Democrats have a much bigger agenda that they would like to pursue on guns than that. They want to close loopholes related to background checks. In the wake of the Dayton shooting, where the shooter used this very large magazine in order to get off an enormous number of rounds within about 30 seconds, you have talk about limiting the size of magazines. What should Democrats be doing here? Because, I mean, if Republicans try, if their offer is basically going to be a red flag law and nothing else, presumably Democrats would like to push for more than that. And then you also saw President Trump tweeting earlier in the week, again, about background checks, which is something he has talked about in addition to red flag laws, but saying he wanted to tie them to immigration reform, which is basically a poison pill to ensure that he wouldn't have to support something that would actually come out of Congress.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think the first thing is, look, it's good to see some movement on the right and on across the board, right, on these issues. We have a national epidemic of gun violence. It's brought home this last week. And people are demanding action. I mean, I think part of why we're seeing the shift is not just the shootings, but it's the larger pressure that's come out of, say, after the Parkland shootings and the March for Our Lives. And there's been a much broader conversation pushing on this. So I think all of that is good. I think the scope of a bill, I think that's where the debate's going to be. And, you know, I think Democrats are right to be pushing for a broader approach. I mean, red flag laws gets us maybe some part of the way there. I think I would have some concerns, too, about how are we actually operationalizing the red flag piece of it, right? And we know that the more discretion there is, the more room there is then for bias and surveillance. And, you know, we have to have conversations about that. But I think it does need to be part of a broader push on assault weapons, on magazines, on background checks. And these are issues that have been floated for a long time. You know, the House passed a bill, a background check bill, earlier in the session. And so I think it'll be important to see what the president actually comes forward with.
Rich, does it matter that the NRA is in enormous internal turmoil right now? I mean, for years, there had been this sense that gun control was a winning issue for Republicans, even when polling showed that certain ideas were broadly popular, basically that people who opposed gun control were more activated around the law, more likely to vote on it. You had a lot of political power of the NRA. Then, as Sabeel notes, you've seen a lot of organizing on the left, specifically around gun issues in the last few years. And then now there's this fight basically over who was wasting the NRA's money and this revelation that that Wayne LaPierre, the longtime president of the NRA, was trying to get them to buy him a multi-million-dollar French-style chateau in a gated community in Dallas, purportedly for security reasons. So is the NRA sort of being on its back right now, does that matter politically in terms of the level of resistance that you might see to new laws on the right?
I think it has to matter, at least at the margins. And the NRA, unfortunately, is a great example of that axiom that every cause becomes a racket over time. And but the NRA's power, though, was never its lobbying per se, is that it represents a lot of real people out there, millions of them, who care about this issue intensely. So that sentiment is still there and would still come to bear, I believe, if there are any sweeping background check legislation advance or anything even more aggressive than that.
Sabeel, you talk about the need for a broader agenda here. How do we figure out which pieces of that agenda are useful and important? Because one of my frustrations about the way that the gun control conversation is conducted is that it tends to be in response to these sorts of mass shootings, when most of the gun violence problem is not mass shootings. It's mostly with handguns, not with assault rifles. And so you tend to have a focus on specific elements of what happened in a shooting and what we can do to prevent that from happening again. And sometimes I think that's fine. Like after the Las Vegas shooting, the use of a bump stock, obviously that is not typical, but there's also like no real legitimate use for a bump stock. So I think taking a lesson from that you should prohibit them was fine. But I think sometimes when we're looking and trying to figure out, you know, how to stop the last shooting, we're not necessarily looking at the things that are actually likely to save a lot of lives.
Yeah, I think it's an important point, Josh. And I think this is part one of the reasons why I think a broader look at things like background checks, licensing, something that looks more widely at the question about the gun violence throughout the country, right? Not just these episodic crises, is going to be really important. You know, if you think about how we got here, right? It's not just these one-offs, right? The incidence of gun violence has been very high and increasing over the last, say, 10, 15 years.
Of
mass shootings.
Not of gun violence.
And so we've lost more Americans to gun violence more broadly than we lose to a lot of other things that we regulate. And so I do think it's a broader question. The other thing also I would say is that the incidence of mass shootings going up, I think we have to explore, as we will later today, this question about the links between these mass shootings and the broader political environment that we're in, the radicalization of individuals, and how that contributes to these problems.
Yeah, I mean, and that's the political mass shootings obviously are a subset of the overall problem. Rich, a thing I hear a lot, especially from conservatives, also sometimes from liberals, is sort of talking about broad societal causes of these sorts of things. And some of these things are kind of dumb, like the violent video games thing. But you hear a lot of people talking about sort of, you know, increased societal atomization, young men who feel purposeless and angry and end up lashing out in this manner. And it seems to me like you're describing a real phenomenon here, but it's often the sort of thing that doesn't feel like it's that amenable to policy, which is a reason to focus, I think, on gun restrictions, because I don't think you're going to fix society as easily as you are going to restrict people's access to tools that allow them to do things if they're in a societal position that makes them inclined to lash out.
Well, I don't think you're going to do either. I think we'll talk about this more later, I assume, but if you look at mass shooters, the common characteristic of all of them is these nihilistic, disconnected, unhappy, lonely men. And some are just general haters that have some grievance. Others are deranged, you know, from mildly disturbed to, you know, untreated schizophrenics, the Dayton shooter somewhere in that category, and some of them are white nationalists. But that's the common theme, is they're all disconnected. So obviously there's a social element of here, but it's not susceptible to fixing. But the gun restrictions also, I mean, all these guys would have passed background checks as they exist now. So you're just sort of catching up private non-commercial sales that don't really play in this phenomenon. The assault weapon ban, you're dealing with cosmetic features. You'd basically be barring the AR-15, the most popular rifle in the country, because of the way it looks and because it's been used in these incidents disproportionately. But there's nothing about its characteristics that wouldn't apply to other guns. Just other guns would be used in the future if you ban the AR-15. The magazine thing, I think, is more intuitive that it would make a difference. But you look at the Parkland shooter, for instance. He researched this question very closely, as a lot of these guys do, as the El Paso shooter did, and used 10-round magazines because he feared that a larger magazine would jam, which they're more likely to do. And if you're at all adept, you can change out a 10-round magazine very quickly, and it doesn't make a difference if you're shooting unarmed civilians.
So, Bill, what do you say to that? I mean, sometimes, obviously, you could have a much more robust gun restriction regime like you see in certain countries like the United Kingdom and Japan, but that would sort of move to a presumption that people are not allowed to own guns unless they can demonstrate a clear purpose, and rather than in the U.S., where we have this constitutional protection. Is there, within that Second Amendment regime, as interpreted in Heller, that establishes an individual right to gun ownership, do these gun restrictions matter very much at the margin, or is Rich right that these sorts of things are unlikely to move the needle very much on the amount of violence?
So I think there are two things there, Josh. I mean, one is, you know, the current system is clearly not working for our country and is putting a lot of lives at risk. And so I think, you know, the question of, you know, empirically, how much would we reduce the incidence of mass shootings if we do one policy versus another? I mean, those are things we should look into. But, you know, I would argue that we have a strong push here, a strong need to put some of these policies into place. I think that the Heller and the McDonald decisions from the Supreme Court are worth talking about here a little bit. You know, there's, yes, the Heller held a for the first time an individualized right to bear arms under the Second Amendment. But people, I think, often forget that even under the scope of Heller, the vast majority of gun reform proposals and current laws in place are still constitutional, right? The issue at Heller did not involve some of the kinds of things that we're talking about here. So I don't see a constitutional bar to this. You know, there's, of course, political debate, policy debate, but the Second Amendment certainly permits the kinds of things that we're talking about.
I think it would be an open question whether an assault weapon ban would pass constitutional muster under Heller. And the evidentiary question of whether these kind of restrictions would make any difference, to the extent we have studies applying here, the Rand Corporation looked very closely at all of them and all the proposals that have been advanced and says, no, there's no evidence that any of these would stop mass shootings.
Can we talk a little bit about mental health? Because politicians always talk about mental health after these sorts of things and sort of the need to do something about mental health, which I think is something that people broadly agree on. But then when you start talking about what to do about mental health, you run into a lot of trouble. In particular, New York Governor Andrew Cuomo tweeted out that we needed a mental health registry. I don't know what that means specifically, but I feel like a lot of people have this idea that you will sort of in advance identify people who are too mentally ill and dangerous to own guns. I just see a lot of trouble going down that road because, I mean, 1 in 2 Americans will have a clinical mental illness at some point in their lives. The vast majority of those people are not dangerous to society. And sort of having the government try to figure out in advance who's dangerous, identify specific people who can't own guns, I just see a lot of trouble. I see a lot of risk where the government goes and starts making up lists of people who haven't been convicted of crimes and says, this citizen is a dangerous person, this citizen is not a dangerous person. Are there productive things to do in this area?
Well, I'm a big fan of more robust mandatory treatment laws. The main effect of this, though, would be, I think, helping, you know, families who have a schizophrenic son or daughter who lives in the basement and refuses to be treated, refuses to take his or her medication, and is completely miserable and a threat to the family, which is a relatively common occurrence compared to mass shootings. But some of the shootings are carried out by people who clearly are desperately mentally ill and don't have the appropriate treatment. The Virginia Tech shooter would be an example of this. But the Dayton shooter, for example, you know, he's in a gray area. He tells people he's having delusions. He tells people he's schizophrenic, but he seems basically functional. So what are you going to do with an example like that? I wish there was something easy to do. I just fear there isn't.
Sabeel?
I think this is sort of like what you were saying earlier, Rich, about how you can't focus too specifically on the particulars of an individual mass shooting incident, right? Because these are actually structural, systemic questions that we're trying to grapple with. That's what makes them so challenging. I worry a lot about the easy resort to mental health as a casual explanation. You know, the vast majority of people struggling with mental health have nothing to do with the kinds of things that we're talking about. And there is a real danger about kind of further stigmatizing issues of mental health, which, if anything, we need to have a broader conversation about in terms of the healthcare needs of so many Americans. You know, when you talk about having a registry, a mental health registry, I find that befuddling too, Josh, and it does make me think about, you know, do we really want the civil libertarian in me and the racial justice advocate in me really worries about you, and do we really want the government making discretionary judgments about who is deserving and who should kind of enjoy different types of freedoms and protections? You know, I think our history of mass surveillance does not bode well, particularly for communities of color, not to mention civil liberties.
This is why I'm a fan of the red flag bills, though, that idea, just because you would have a chance to block disturbed people from getting the tool of mayhem, and there'd be due process involved. So they're dangerous to this idea in terms of civil liberties, too, but I think, you know, if we're talking about a mental health registry or sweeping bans on guns, those to me seem dangerous impingements on people's rights potentially, whereas this would be more narrowly tailored to the problem.
Well, and also I think another key distinction is that the red flag laws are a bottom-up solution where you're relying on people who are close to right. The people who might have a red flag raised about them to raise the concerns rather than top-down from the government. So right. At least,
well, you know, just another thing, yeah. Dayton, you know, he had a kill list at school, a rape list at school. There was one day when apparently hundreds of kids didn't show up at his high school because they were afraid he's going to carry out an attack. And this is a common theme. A lot of these shooters, people were afraid of them. So there should be some way to meaningfully act on that.
Let's take a break. I will be back with Rich Lowry of National Review and Sabeel Rahman of Demos to talk about mass shootings as domestic terrorism. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
What do you think? Share your thoughts on today's show on our Facebook page or tweet us at LRCKCRW and download the KCRW app to listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm Josh Barrow of New York Magazine. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Sabeel Rahman, president of Demos. The shooter in El Paso left behind a manifesto making clear he had a political motivation when he targeted Hispanics at that Walmart store in El Paso. He was angry about Hispanic immigration to Texas. Specifically, he called it an invasion. And invasion is also a term the president has often used to talk about Hispanics coming to the United States, whether entering illegally or coming here to seek asylum. To talk about the diffuse white nationalist movement that has produced several mass shooters in the last few years and what relationship it may have to the president's political movement and rhetoric, we're joined now by Jane Costin. Jane is senior politics reporter at Vox, where she writes about conservatism and the American right. Hi, Jane.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. Jane, we're seeing a lot of Democratic presidential candidates being asked this week whether Donald Trump is a white nationalist. What is a white nationalist?
So I'm very glad you asked that question because I think it's a good point to start with a definition. So white nationalism is a subset of white supremacist rhetoric more generally. However, white nationalists believe that the only solution to impending, and I'm using air quotes, which I know doesn't really work for a podcast, but impending white genocide is to create ethnostates that would be determined by race. And so, for example, Richard Spencer is a white nationalist who has talked about how perhaps we need some sort of passive ethnic cleansing to create a white ethnostate. And one of the things that you see when white nationalists attempt to talk in mainstream circles is that they make this comparison like, oh, well, it would be like Israel. Israel is a Jewish state, indicating they know, one, nothing about Israel, but also this idea that racial diversity is impossible and that it will only result in, quote-unquote, white genocide. And so the best thing to do is to create a white ethnostate. In the late 1970s, part of this became a focus on the Pacific Northwest and Idaho as possible locations for a white ethnostate. If anyone listening remembers the Ruby Ridge, those were white nationalists who had taken to Idaho, as had a lot of people in the Pacific Northwest, as being kind of the last stand for whiteness, and that's why white nationalists in the United States focused really heavily on the Pacific Northwest, and that's something that you see even today, if anyone remembers that there, just a couple of months ago, there was a man who, a federal employee, I believe he was with the Coast Guard, who had been writing a lot of letters to white nationalist leaders, and he brought up the Pacific Northwest as well as being kind of the focal point for a future white ethnostate in the United States.
So what do you think is the right way to talk about the president's relationship to people who feel that way? Because I think, you know, if you look at the president's rhetoric and political agenda, I think it's fair to say that he's concerned about the increased diversity of the United States, that, you know, while he has a negative view toward immigration in general, he seems to have a positive view toward immigration from Europe. But that doesn't seem to me quite the same as seeking to establish a white ethnostate. It seems like the president wants to, you know, sort of retain what has been the situation in America for a long time, where you have a hegemonic white majority.
I think that, you know, when you talk to white nationalists in 2015, 2016, they basically saw Trump as a conduit to mainstream approval, even if not mainstream culture more generally, the mainstream Republican Party. And you've seen efforts by white nationalist organizations to attempt to subsume themselves to the Republican Party or gain entree into the Republican Party at the state level, state and local level. But I think, you know, and there's been a lot of talk since, I'd say, 2017, 2018, about how a lot of white nationalists are very disappointed with Trump. A reminder that white nationalists lie a lot. But it's worth noting that Trump, his inability to turn down a hypothetical supporter, I think, is really playing a part here. And then white nationalists and white supremacist organizations, individuals more generally, thought, you know, this is someone who is coming closer than anyone has to saying the things that we already think. You know, we will be supportive of him, but sort of in the way that you're supportive of someone who kind of edges close to what you think, but not necessarily like they were, you know, they were not necessarily all on the Trump train, but they were supportive of the fact that his messaging and their messaging seemed close enough that they could kind of take credit for it in some sense.
Rich, does that sound fair to you? The president sort of trying to keep these sorts of people at arm's length, but not quite push them away, benefit from some sort of, you know, implicit alignment with them? And then doesn't that mean that he bears a significant amount of moral culpability for what they've been doing?
Well, I think Jane's analysis is very subtle and very acute, and I agree with a lot of it. I think at times he's had this attitude of there are no enemies to my right. The David Duke incident was one of the foremost among them. At other times, he's denounced these people. So I think part of it is, Jane says, he has like a Manhattanite's view, or did, of what their base of the Republican Party is. Part of it is he has a 1970s guy from Queens attitude towards racial matters generally, you know, very sort of stereotypical view of racial divisions. So, you know, this is a lot of it's blameworthy. It's just I really object to the leap that a lot of people make that he himself is a white nationalist or a white supremacist and or is responsible for what happened in El Paso.
Sabil, what do you think about that?
So I don't think there's any question that the president is a white supremacist in the sense that someone who is trying to defend and preserve the idea of hegemonic white rule, as you put it earlier, Josh. I think what we're debating is what's the link between that and the white nationalism of folks like the El Paso shooter and the manifesto that he laid out. And I mean, I think with related to what Jane said, I mean, I think it's more than just an implicit signaling from the president. This has become a two-way courtship. And, you know, whether it's deeply felt by Trump or a cynical ploy just to build political support, kind of doesn't matter either way when you have the megaphone of the White House openly engaging and kind of creating that lane for white nationalists to see themselves reflected at the centers of political power. That's a problem for the country. And I think it's something we have to reckon with when, you know, the words in the El Paso Shooter's Manifesto, all the argument laid out there about invasion, about replacement, these are all more or less verbatim kind of snippets that you can see in the president's rhetoric, in Fox News, right? And again, whether it's deeply felt by the individuals on TV or in the White House or not, the point is there's been an active fomenting of these types of languages that cause people harm.
Well, and then, Rich, I think another thing is obviously there's a whole spectrum of increasing extremism, people in between where the president is and where people like the El Paso shooter is. And I think the president has not dealt well with that. I mean, for example, when he was talking at that rally down in the Florida Panhandle a few months ago about, you know, what to do about keeping people out. And he says, you know, well, you know, we can't use guns. Other countries do that. We're not going to do that. And then someone in the crowd shouts out, shoot them. And the president sort of chuckles and says, only in the Panhandle. And so the president is not out there saying shoot people across the border, but he's also, you know, he's treating that as something that is funny and amusing and sort of winking to a part of his base that is more extreme than he is and sort of validating the appropriateness of being that extreme, even if he's not going to say it himself.
Well, I read that moment as it's a good-natured way to say that's an outlandish view. But his – look, the fault with Trump – as he whips up crowds and always plays the crowds and will never have like a John McCain moment. Like, no, did you just hear what I said? We're not going to use weapons, or just ignore it and let it go. Because actually people laughed and clapped and thought it was funny when he said that about the Panhandle. So,
but doesn't he have a moral responsibility to do that? I mean, I get that this is part of his personality, but it's like it's an important and bad part of his personality.
Yeah, look, his rhetoric is often crude and inflammatory and degrades our public discourse that has all sorts of bad effects. I think the most direct bad effect is, you know, the way like Beto O'Rourke has talked about this over the last week, you know, the language he's used, which he probably wouldn't have done if Trump hadn't been president for 3 years and degraded our discourse. But just the leap from that to culpability, I think is, as I said, way too far and is a poisonous smear of the president.
I think it's also not just rhetoric, right? I mean, I think the president has specific policy agenda that adds, you know, provides data points for the white nationalists looking for, you know, support in this way, right? So if you add up the rhetoric, family separations at the border, the ICE raid in Mississippi the other day, the way the president systematically targets and attacks political leaders of color, whoever they in the Congress, right? There's a, you add these things together, and it's not just a nod and a wink, right? There is a whole set of things that the White House is putting out there policy wise and rhetoric wise that is fueling this permission. This sort of implicit to explicit permission structure that is a problem for us. And last thing I'd say is that, I think we can all agree that whatever our political differences and policy differences, you know, white nationalism is a threat to the idea of democracy and is a threat to our fellow citizens and our fellow community members. And so, you know, I think it's good that we're having this debate as a country. And I think the challenge for us will be, you know, can we have this debate in a way that helps people, helps the country get past this and try not to get into sort of the both sides-ism that often, you know, gets into the traditional commentary.
Jane, one thing that we're seeing this week is increasing, you know, calling this by its name. You're seeing Democrats and Republicans talking about this as white nationalist terrorism, a domestic terrorism threat. As that becomes something that is getting more public focus in Washington, and I know it's something that the FBI and the Department of Homeland Security have been working on with less public notice for years, what are the options facing the government as they try to figure out, you know, what do we do about this rising extremism that can lead to violent terroristic attacks? What do we do to try to stop that?
So already the FBI and the Department of Justice have been attempting to make an effort to pursue white nationalists who might be prone to violence. I think it's telling that one of the first responses to the purported manifesto posted by the El Paso shooter on 8chan was, "Hello, FBI." You know, they know they're being observed. And I think that is something a couple of people who work on this issue have brought up, the point that shutting down 8chan makes it more difficult for the FBI and other law enforcement agencies to track people who might be prone to violence.
Sorry, for listeners who might not be familiar,
sorry.
8chan maybe now was, at least it's having difficulty staying online, an internet message board that was basically formed because 4chan, which was a sewer of hate and disgusting posting, was sort of not free enough. And so this one attracted a lot of white nationalist posters, and including that you see people perpetrating these mass shootings going on there beforehand basically to brag and explain why they're doing what they're doing, and then you get people responding to that, cheering them on more or less and urging on a high body count.
Right, and they also impact the 8chan audience is very much kind of the editorial board for some of these terrorist manifestos. You see in both Christchurch, New Zealand, and in El Paso, very much of an idea like this is, you know, the stylistic choices used, even just in basic wording, used in these manifestos and specific notes that they know will appeal to 8chan readers. For example, if people remember, the Christchurch shooter made reference to Candace Owens and a host of other, you know, random specific notes, because they recognize that people would focus on that and get everyone all distracted and 8chan would be entertained. But I think, you know, we've seen a lot of 2020 Democrats call for the FBI and other law enforcement agencies to do more about the issue of white nationalism, including codifying the term domestic terror as itself a crime. When, for example, Timothy McVeigh was eventually charged for committing the Oklahoma City bombing, he was not charged with the crime of domestic terrorism. He was charged with, I believe, federal weapons charges and the use of, you know, bomb-making materials. And, you know, when the El Paso shooter, who's already been charged, he will be charged with gun charges and with murder, essentially. And so there's been kind of a call to codify domestic terror as itself a crime that you could charge under. However, the concern that I think a lot of people have when observing the FBI and Department of Justice, people who were not born, like, within the last 5 years, is that historically, though FBI Director Christopher Wray has repeatedly made the point that the FBI does not police ideology, that's been shown not to be true. And I think there's been, you know, recent documentation from the FBI showing that they absolutely have policed ideology, and in 2018 believed that, quote unquote, black identity extremism posed a bigger danger to the United States than Al-Qaeda. And so there's been a lengthy history. I think Rich brought it up in his piece on this issue about COINTELPRO and how, you know, the FBI's efforts to go after the Klan, for example, in the American Nazi Party, also included efforts to go after the quote-unquote New Left, the Black Panthers, and all of this resulted in, you know, constitutional rights violations and constitutional rights violations to both Klansmen and people associated with the civil rights movement. And so, you know, there has been a cut to resources to fight white nationalist extremism since the 1990s in response to 9/11, but also in response to, I think, concerns from conservatives, especially from a 2009 Department of Homeland Security report on right-wing extremism. That apparently made people very upset because right-wing extremism is upsetting. But I think that there's also concern that the Department of Homeland Security has had some programs for anti-extremism efforts, like Life After Hate, to encourage white nationalists to reform. But, you know, to increase funding for domestic terrorism to the FBI and the Department of Justice, one would also be increasing funding to an organization that has been known to go after civil rights activists, animal rights activists. Now, I'm not saying that none of those people could have possibly done bad things or have done bad things, but it's worth noting that what the government says is domestic terrorism and what everyday Americans say is domestic terrorism has had a tendency to differ, you know, over the last 30, 40 years.
Yeah, Rich, as Jane notes, you wrote your column on this week and sort of about the FBI's success at undermining the Klan, but sort of the problems in the process of what they did more broadly there that Jane discusses. Do you think a new law here on domestic terrorism is useful? And then what do we learn from that experience decades ago when here, I mean, most of that, you know, that effort against the Klan, efforts you see against international terrorist organizations aim at organizations.
Right.
These people in general do not have organizations.
Yeah, so I wasn't familiar with the FBI's history in any detail with the Klan, and what's most infamous is what the FBI did against civil rights groups and Martin Luther King. They actually sent a letter to Martin Luther King hoping it would cause him to commit suicide. So it was one of the most hideous abuses of law enforcement powers in American history. But they're very serious in their anti-Klan effort. It was extremely effective. They infiltrated these groups. They came to control these groups. They set these groups against one another. They, by the time they were done, you know, the membership was from like 14,000 to 4,000. The speechwriter for the president of the United Klans of America was a FBI informant who was trying to influence his views and moderate him. So on the one hand, it was, you know, it helped destroy the Klan as an effective force. On the other hand, you know, this is domestic law enforcement manipulating a domestic political group. So the reaction after this was never again. The FBI and the New Left and the socialists, everyone that the FBI was manipulating in this way. All that said, I do think there's more of a call for an intelligence-based policing approach where you learn about these groups, you're on every one of these message boards. If someone crosses the line from incitement on one of these boards, someone should be paying attention. They should be prosecuted. People should get visited. They should get interviews. Like the Pulse nightclub shooter was interviewed by the FBI. And I don't think we've heard about any of these white nationalist shooters, you know, being on the FBI's radar screen. You hope as many of them as possible will be in the future.
So, Bill, one thing that's been remarkable to me is the deplatforming of 8chan in the days after the attack was done through a series of decisions by private actors, through companies that provide internet hosting services and such. And essentially, this is who decides whether 8chan is going to get to exist anymore or not. And, you know, it seems to me that they have made the right decision now, but it's also, it's completely removed from public policy. And I'm trying to figure out what the government can or should do. I mean, having the government go out and ban websites certainly seems like a thing that could run afoul of the First Amendment and cause all sorts of problems. But it feels weird that we're at the mercy of these private companies to make what are essentially important public policy decisions.
Yeah, it's a great point, Josh, and I think it's part of what makes the current sort of nexus of mass shootings and white nationalism so hard to disentangle, right? Because I on the one hand, I think Rich is right and Jane is right too, that the FBI already has quite a bit of authority that, if anything, it's been underutilizing on the white nationalist front in recent years. And so you could imagine reallocating resources to move that. But I think what you're pointing to, Josh, is that it's just a different media ecosystem now where so much of our flow of information that is now runs through these private companies that are governed by either their own profit motive or in various kind of self-governed forms like these internet boards. And, you know, I think it's got to be part of the policy solution. I mean, direct regulation, you have all sorts of First Amendment problems there. But, you know, I'd want us to think about even things like the business incentives of, say, a Twitter or a YouTube actually helps spur along some of the radicalization that we're talking about here. So, you know, if you look at the way these algorithms work on some social media platforms, like they're designed to increase attention, right? Increase the time spent on the website. The best way to do that, because of the way the brain works, is to just feed people more and more extreme versions of the things that they already kind of like. And pretty soon that can lead you down all sorts of different rabbit holes. And some of it is innocuous, some of it isn't. And so the policy solution there is complicated because of what you're talking about, but it's got to be part of the conversation here.
Jane, do you see a way forward on that?
I think it's going to be incredibly complicated. You know, I want to remind listeners is that the FBI's efforts to shut down the Klan were not just because that the Klan was committing domestic terrorism against American citizens, but because that domestic terrorism was embarrassing to the United States government as it attempted to contest the Cold War. You know, the Klan came up a lot in Soviet propaganda and in Maoist propaganda during the late 1950s and early 1960s. And so I think, you know, when we're talking about the responses of social media platforms or the government itself, it's worth contemplating why they're having these responses. And I also think that, you know, the thing that a lot of people aren't aware of, and I feel like that it's difficult to parse out, is that closing down 8chan just means people will move. You know, they're going to move to Telegram, which is a messaging service. It's interesting because I think that this is a moment in which you actually can see some parallels with ISIS and other terrorist groups. Rukmini Kalamaki at New York Times has done a lot of work on how ISIS uses Telegram and other messaging services now that because Facebook and Twitter have attempted to remove basically every ISIS-related account tried to do so. But I think it's worth recognizing that the people who are likely to commit violence are going to just keep moving to a different platform because this is, you know, historically, you know, when the Order, for example, in the early 1980s, a white nationalist organization responsible for multiple murders and bank robberies as well, they spread their message through newsletters you would get in the mail. And, you know, while that didn't get the same kind of, you know, pickup, it still got followers and attention, particularly from people who responded to their message and were willing to commit violence because of that message. And so I think that the real challenge for social media companies and for others, one, is that no matter what they do, white nationalists and others who are interested in committing violence will simply move to another platform. Two, in the United States, and I feel like it's worth stating, it's not illegal to be a white nationalist. It is not illegal to spread white nationalist messages. You know, I think that the issue of incitement is both a legal one and a political one, but it's not illegal to do any of this. And so I think that plays an important part in how social media companies will deal with this. But I also think that there's some degree of, you know, I think there should be some degree of self-consideration taken on the part of people behind social media platforms and behind efforts by the government to curtail the spread of white nationalism, to contemplate, you know, why these platforms have become sites for radicalization, how that radicalization is happening, you know, how and mm-hmm. you know what they're prepared to actually do to stop the spread of radicalizing white nationalist messaging. Because I think that one of the issues that they're going to find is that that messaging has spread a lot further than the violence has. And I think that that's something worth considering.
Jane Costin is senior politics reporter at Vox. Jane, thanks for joining us.
Of course. Thank you so much.
I've been talking with Sabeel Rahman of Demos and Rich Lowry of National Review. We'll be back with Brad Setzer to talk about the trade and now currency war with China. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
Join the conversation on our Facebook page or tweet us at LRCKCRW. Stream all episodes of Left, Right, and Center and other great shows at kcrw.com/podcasts.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm your host, Josh Barrow. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Sabeel Rahman, president of Demos. We talked last week about President Trump's escalation in the trade war with China. The president announced last week his intention to apply a 10% tariff to $300 billion of additional Chinese imports. That means nearly all U.S. imports from China will be subject to significant tariffs, raising the price of everything from toys to iPhones. On Monday, China responded by allowing its currency to fall. There are now more than 7 Chinese yuan to the U.S. dollar, the lowest level in about a decade. President Trump responded by officially designating China as a currency manipulator. Stock markets absolutely tanked on Monday after the fall in the yuan, and since then they've been on a roller coaster as market participants struggle to figure out how much all of this matters and what kind of risks it poses to the U.S. economy. That's also something Donald Trump might be interested in, as a strong economy is one of the things he has going for him as he heads into re-election. Joining us now to discuss how the currency war matters is Brad Setzer. Brad is a senior fellow in international economics at the Council on Foreign Relations. Hi, Brad.
Hi.
So why does it matter for the U.S. if China's currency weakens?
A weaker currency helps a country export more. It helps China make up for the impact on its exports of the U.S. tariffs, and it offsets some of the impact.
So basically, the president is distressed about the large and persistent trade deficit that we have with China, that China exports more to us than we export to them. When the Chinese currency weakens, that will tend to increase that trade deficit, right?
All else equal, and all else isn't equal. Because of the tariffs. So.
But we've been seeing a growing trade deficit with China even during the tariffs. Didn't the president think that imposing tariffs was going to shrink our trade deficit with China?
The trade deficit with China actually has come down if you look at the U.S. data. What hasn't come down is the trade deficit with the world. And so what you see is we're importing more from Vietnam, importing more from Mexico, and almost actually more important than that, we're just not exporting that much right now. So the overall trade deficit has continued to gone up. But to be fair, the tariffs have had some impact on the bilateral balance. I think the big concern, though, is not that the yuan may have gone from 6.9 to 7, is that it may continue to go down. And if it continues to go down enough, that would have a much bigger offsetting effect.
So, Rich, a key problem I think we've had here is a lack of clarity about exactly what it is we want out of China. I mean, we have a long list of grievances. We want them to respect American intellectual property. We want them to give access to their market for U.S. firms. And the president certainly wants a decrease in both the trade deficit with China and the global trade deficit. What I think we haven't seen is a clear prioritization and a clear strategy as to whether some of the things he's doing actually end up undermining some of those goals.
Well, I think we want enforceable commitments that China would change the way it operates. And that's just very difficult to get. And I always thought there'd be some sort of papered over deal to get Trump, you know, past 2020. Seems at this juncture that wouldn't happen. And that maybe the odds are more likely that we continue to spiral downward, which goes to the flaw in the method here. You know, when all you're using is tariffs, when China does something you don't like, all you have is more tariffs. And, you know, that has all sorts of follow-on effects that are unhealthy. And you guys who know more about economic policy than I do, maybe my understanding, though, is if you have tariffs and the demand for Chinese goods goes down, you're going to exert downward pressure on the Chinese currency. So maybe they're, quote-unquote, manipulating on some level, but it's also kind of a dynamic that you're helping force yourself. So this is clearly having some effect on growth, even if it's just the uncertainty discouraging economic growth, but it's not a healthy dynamic at the moment.
Brad, what do you make of the currency manipulator designation? Because am I right to understand it that basically it's not that China pushed its currency down on Monday, it's that it stopped pushing its currency up and then it basically was allowed to fall in the market? So that wasn't really them manipulating their currency when the currency fell, right?
I agree with that. So since the trade talks broke down, and particularly since the president threatened to raise tariffs even further, the basic direction of market pressure on China's currency has been for it to weaken. And China was pushing back in kind of very technical ways, very technical but effective ways, until Friday and Monday, and it sort of stopped pushing back. Now, of course, China has a regime where it manages its currency's moves on any given day. So the proximate cause of the weakening on Monday was a signal by the Chinese that they wouldn't push back.
Sabil, it sort of feels to me like a lot of the conversation about China and its currency got set in 2012. This was a big issue in the presidential campaign. Mitt Romney said he was going to declare China a currency manipulator on day one of his presidency. That was at a time when China really was acting to push its currency down rather than up. Do you see, I mean, even if we don't see clarity from the president, do you see clarity from Democrats on a strategy here? Elizabeth Warren, I think, is the candidate who's talked most specifically about this. And one thing she has said is that she would like to manage the dollar in an effort to promote exports, which seems to me, along with her skepticism of a lot of these trade deals, to actually put her in line with Donald Trump, not necessarily on strategy, but at least on vision for trade and currency.
Yeah, it's a great question, Josh. I mean, clarity might be a too strong a term, but I do think we're finally having a really important unpacking of what, among the progressive candidates, what a trade policy and, for that matter, a foreign policy really needs to be in the 21st century. So, I mean, in some ways, the China debate is exactly at that intersection of two big things that we never really figured out, I think, as a country, but particularly among progressives. One is, what is the future of the global economic infrastructure that we want to see? And two is, how do we achieve and kind of promote America's position in the world, and what does that look like? I see the Warren plan on trade as being a really important, good first step at trying to answer some of these questions. So there's still really big open questions left. Three things I'd call it in particular about her proposal, which I think are interesting. One is that she's taking on some of the skepticism of trade that I think Trump used to his advantage in the 2016 election, and giving some progressive teeth to it around this pushback on the power that investors have around settling trade disputes. You see that in the TPP. You see that in a bunch of the trade deals that were struck in the 90s and 2000s. The second thing that she's talking about, which I think is interesting, is, do we need to set more preconditions as in terms of the U.S. before we go into a deeper trade agreement with a trading partner? So labor standards, she has some talk about carbon tax there. You know, what that policy looks like, we'd have to hash out, but that's an important shift. And the third is making these trade deals much more transparent and open to public debate, right, rather than fast-tracked and secret negotiated. And so that gets us part of the way there. I don't know if it answers fully the kind of broader questions about what we're going to do about the trade deficit and how we're going to counter the rising influence of China diplomatically in the global arena.
So Brad, I mean, this issue of imbalances with China has been around with us for, you know, at least a couple of decades at this point, even as the economic circumstances around it have changed. And I think it's something that successive administrations have struggled with. No one has really landed on an effective strategy here. What what would need to be done in order to balance our economic relationship with China, whether around currency or trade or any other aspect of this? How do we is it really the case that basically this persistent trade deficit has caused economic problems in the United States in the form of, for example, elevated unemployment? And if so, how do we put pressure on China in order to change that?
There's about 20 different embedded questions there. I don't think you can think of China as a constant impact on the U.S. labor market. There was unambiguously a large impact on U.S. employment, U.S. manufacturing employment, the regions of the country that rely most on manufacturing in the 6 years after China joined the WTO. China joins the WTO in 2002.
2002. Okay.
All right. So it's in the 6 years in the run up to the global financial crisis. That is the period of time when China not only is running a rising trade surplus with the United States, but its overall trade surplus is soaring, and its intervention in the foreign currency market was setting new records almost every day. So I think you can make a strong case that China was a manipulator then, and that ending that manipulation would have been a helpful step. So China had a big impact. China, after the global financial crisis, did a very large stimulus, and its economy is now more domestically oriented than it was before the global financial crisis. So at the margin, China hasn't been the main incremental source of pressure on manufacturing employment, nor has it necessarily been the biggest incremental source of pressure on the trade deficit. The big source of pressure on the trade deficit, looking at manufacturing, there's a different story in oil. I think we all know that, was the fact that the dollar rose in 2014. And then you see the U.S. struggling to export and compete in global markets against Europe, Japan, Korea, not just against China. That is also having an impact on the manufacturing sector, but that's a little bit distinct from the particular issues that China now poses. One of the things where I think China does still pose a real problem is its industrial policies. China more or less has said it doesn't want to import, at least not aircraft, not semiconductors, not medical equipment, the stuff we should still be able to export. Now, China isn't yet in a position where it can displace Intel and Boeing and GE's medical equipment from its market, but it's signaled that that's the direction of travel. And that's a really tough issue for the United States.
And so what risks do we face right now as the president imposes these tariffs, as you get these responses from China? How much should we worry about the domestic U.S. economy, how it can be affected by this dispute?
If the president goes ahead with the 10% tariff on the last $300 billion, and you add in the other tariffs that have already been imposed, the 25% tariff on $250 billion, the president would be proposing, assuming nothing else changes and things will change, tariffs of about $90 billion, or about a half point of U.S. GDP. In the first instance, that's money taken out of the hands of American consumers. In the short run, it's a shock to consumer spending, and then you have the uncertainty effect. So it's a drag on the U.S. economy. It isn't so big that on its own, it should be enough to tip the U.S. into a recession, but unambiguously, it's not helpful. The question really is the short-term pain worth the long-term gain? And that's where the question about what is the president really negotiating for? What's the strategy here? Those questions become important in evaluating whether the costs are worth it.
Brad Setzer is a senior fellow in international economics at the Council on Foreign Relations. Brad, thank you for speaking with us.
My pleasure.
We've reached that time once again for our famed Left, Right, and Center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Rich Lowry, it's your soapbox.
There was an amazing moment at the Dallas-Fort Worth Airport this week. The remains of American pilots shot down in Vietnam in 1967, Colonel Roy Knight, were finally returned to the U.S. He had left for Vietnam from the very same airport, and his five-year-old son had waved goodbye from the airfield. So many decades later, the plane bringing him back was piloted by his son. Welcome home, sir. Rest in peace.
So, Bill Rahman, what's on your mind?
Well, after the events of this week, Josh, I've especially been thinking about the 1873 massacre in Colfax, Louisiana, right after the Civil War. And in Colfax, what happened was a group of white supremacists stormed the courthouse gates in an attempt to overturn the results of the local election, killing somewhere between 60 and 150 black freed persons. And the wildest thing about this isn't even that instance of violence. It's what happened after in the legal case. The Supreme Court threw out the murder convictions of Cruikshank and his co-conspirators on a pretty half-baked 14th Amendment theory, which then gutted a number of the civil rights laws that the Congress had put in place after Reconstruction, helping usher in the period of Jim Crow. I think about that a lot this week because I think about first our country getting out of this moment of rising white nationalism, threats to civil rights. It's not just about the rhetoric and the policies and the voting in the electoral box. It's going to involve pretty deep changes, I think, to our legal, civil rights, constitutional structures. And do we have a Supreme Court that's willing to go there, I think, is a really big question for us.
For my rant, I just want to note a worrying development in the intelligence apparatus this week. We already knew that President Trump was forcing out Director of National Intelligence Dan Coats, his own appointee. He's also now forcing out Deputy Director of National Intelligence Sue Gordon, who would have by law stepped in as acting DNI once Coats was gone. It is clear the president wants a political loyalist overseeing the intelligence apparatus. He tried to get Texas Congressman John Ratcliffe named to that position, despite his lack of apparent qualifications. That is not going to work. We will see how the president fills this role. But again, we want intelligence to be provided to the president in an apolitical matter. That is clearly not how President Trump wishes to receive it, and he is taking steps to make sure that he doesn't have to. That's all we have time for today. I want to thank Rich Lowry, Sabeel Rahman, Jane Costin, and Brad Setzer. Left, Right, and Center is produced by Sarah Fay. Our technical director is J.C. Swadek. Katie Berskins and Colin Cab Washington are our production assistants. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. I'm Josh Barrow. Thanks for joining us, and tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download and subscribe at kcrw.com/LRC, the KCRW app, or wherever you find podcasts. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.